Welcome back to the program. For the past several weeks, all eyes have been on Boston. In some ways, it's a good reminder of the important role that that city has played in our nation's history. For along with Philadelphia and New York, Boston is the fulcrum from which the revolution is launched. Now best-selling author Nathaniel Philbrick, author of In the Heart of the Sea and Mayflower, tells the story of Boston that triggered the American Revolution. It is my pleasure to welcome Nathaniel Philbrick back to this program to talk about his newest work, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. Nathaniel Philbrick, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be back.
It's great to have you here. We often don't give Boston enough credit, I think, for the important role that it did play in launching the revolution. We all know, you know, the Boston Tea Party in 1775, but we forget that it really was a center of the action of that period of time.
Absolutely. You know, and it's interesting. It was the example of Boston after the Tea Party when the British Ministry instituted the Boston Port Act, which shut down the city commercially and sent several thousand soldiers as an occupying force into the city. It was when this happened that an outpouring of sympathy occurred throughout the colonies. As far south as Charleston, South Carolina, they were sending up sacks of grain to help feed the people of Boston. And so Boston became one of the first times that all the colonies were on the same page. You know, they were beginning to see themselves as in it together. And that really hadn't happened before. And it completely surprised the British because they were used to the colonies fighting amongst each other rather than acting as in sympathy.
One of the other things you capture in Bunker Hill is the sense of tension that is slowly and progressively ratcheted up in Boston from around 1773 forward, and just the way in which it had an impact on the city itself.
Yeah, you know, all my books are about communities under enormous stress in a way. And from the start with Bunker Hill, I knew I wanted to focus on the city of Boston. And you know, Boston was very different geographically and topography sense from what it is now. It was an island. It was isolated. It was 1.2 square miles, an island connected to the land by only a thin neck to Roxbury. 15,000 people lived on it. It was dominated by three hills, and you know, these people were packed into a very small, almost medieval town, and with all these crooked streets and 50 wharves branching out, and surrounded by this immense harbor with dozens of other islands. And so Boston was this separate place, and when you add some soldiers to it, it becomes this kind of petri dish of human behavior as tensions build. As you know, Americans have seen occupying forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and know the tensions that soldiers are experience, and the similar kinds of things were happening to the British soldiers. It was just not fun to be in a city where you were resented by the inhabitants.
And as that tension built up, there were numerous players that rose to the surface as leaders of what was going on, people other than the people like John Adams and Sam Adams and others that we're very familiar with.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the whole new cast of characters, really, because John, the people you just named, the patriots we all associate with Boston, most of them were off-site in this time period at the two Continental Congresses that convened in 74 and 75. And it meant that there were different people involved in creating the on-the-ground revolution. The person I focus on is a 33-year-old physician named Dr. Joseph Warren. And he quickly emerged as the person that was making it happen. He was a charismatic leader, highly eloquent, great writer. He would write the Suffolk Resolves that were passed by the First Continental Congress and pushed that body in a more radical direction than many would have wanted to go otherwise. He would be the one who would give Paul Revere the order that to send out the alarm that the British were headed to Lexington and Concord. And so, you know, he had a pivotal role, but he would die at Bunker Hill at that battle in the last charge. And he's just not part of the pantheon most of us associate with the early days of the Revolution.
It was striking to note, too, in all of our attention focused on Boston a couple of weeks ago, that the marathon takes place on a day that they refer to as Patriot Day in Boston, which incorporates so much of this history.
Yeah, I mean, it was just such a horrible tragedy, and particularly given the timing of it. Patriots Day is the Monday closest to April 19th, when Lexington Concord occurred, and that's when the Boston Marathon is run. It's a state holiday in Massachusetts. It's a day everyone enjoys and celebrates under most circumstances, and it's very historical. There are all sorts of reenactments. It's a time when Massachusetts really reconnects with its past, the past that set the stage for the creation of America. And so when this tragedy unfolded, I mean, it just was, tore myself and everyone in Massachusetts and throughout the country and the world in terrible directions by seeing what was going on.
Why does Joseph Warren, who you were talking about a few minutes ago, who pulled all of this together, who supervised the organization of the Continental Army at that point, why does he get so little, if any, historical attention?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He did die at the Battle of Bunker Hill, and he, you know, as a consequence, he wasn't around when the nation building began. But, you know, it's deeper than that, because he was a hero after it. He was a true national figure for several generations. There are towns around the country named Warren in his honor. But what he didn't have was a large number of papers. He didn't have the journals, the letters, the diaries, for example, that John Adams left to posterity, or Washington. And as a consequence, there's just not the stuff in the archives to focus for historians to focus on. And as a consequence, since he, shuffled off the stage so early on, it's been easier, I think, for people to write the history, essentially leaving him out. And it's just not the way it unfolded. He was the central figure in Boston, and his loss was a profound shock to everyone in Massachusetts and New England. Mm-hmm. And, it added a real vacuum that set the context for Washington's arrival a few weeks after the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Talk about 1773 and the Tea Party as kind of the beginning of this period that ultimately resolved in the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Yeah, one of the things I realized was, we think of the revolution beginning with the Stamp Act back in 1765, and then there was the Boston Massacre in 1770. But there was another development that I think was even more important than all of that, and it's little noticed. It was in the late 1772, Samuel Adams came up with an original idea called the Boston Committee of Correspondence, a 21-person committee that began to send out open letters to the 250 towns outside Boston throughout Massachusetts, which then included what's modern Maine. And in these were open letters discussing the issues of the day. And what they created an independent network of communication that allowed people in town meetings, which, were usually the way towns decided how to build roads and bridges and stuff like that. Now they became forums on what was happening between Britain and her colonies. They were really creating chat rooms in every town hall throughout the colony. And so with the formation of the Committee of Correspondence, everything changed. Suddenly people were seeing Boston as part of their own destiny. And it knit people together, and then there were committees being formed in other colonies, and it was this network of communication that created the tensions that contributed to the Boston Tea Party, and then contributed to the fact that the rest of the colonies saw themselves as sharing the Massachusetts fate. And so I think all of that was very important.
Part of what drove the tension as well was the extreme, some would argue, overreaction of the British to the Tea Party itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a major overreaction. The Boston Tea Party involved about 100 people, who, you know, it was very choreographed. It was stagecrafted as an ideological event, and the British government reacted overreacted by shutting down the Boston as a commercial port, eventually shutting down its government, putting in a military governor, appointing legislators that had used to be elected, and just infuriating the entire province and ultimately all the colonies. And poor Thomas Gage, who was the military general and governor, was put in an impossible situation. It was his job to implement these acts, but what happened was he had the soldiers to keep Boston contained, but there is no way he could had the manpower to deal with the rest of the colony. And so Boston quickly became a militarily occupied city under a Patriot siege.
Part of the problem is that the British never got it right on either side of the equation, that there was too much liberty before and too much repression after.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the big problem really was self-created, because Massachusetts had been started back in 1630, 10 years after the arrival of the Pilgrims in Plymouth Colony, with the Puritans, who had come, like the Pilgrims, to worship as they wanted. They wanted to get away from the English government so they could do what they wanted. And this sense of creating an autonomous enclave to do as they wished was a profound part of the DNA of all New Englanders. And in the beginning, the crown allowed this to happen. They had their own revolution in England, but New Englanders became used to doing it on their own and not really being taxed, and they saw it as their own destiny, that their grandparents had fought for fought in Indian wars to preserve their liberties. And so when Britain decided that it was time to move the empire in a modern direction, to organize the thing and to make all her colonies pay for their royal upkeep, New Englanders said, wait a minute, where were you when we needed you? We're not about to start paying for the privilege of being told what to do. And it came as a great shock to the English to realize what they had created, because each town had its own militia, armed citizens who knew how to fight and had fought in previous French and Indian wars, and it created a situation that would be impossible for Gage and anyone else that followed to manage.
The other aspect is the degree to which it was so reactive, the revolution. There wasn't an overarching plan, it seems. There wasn't an idea that the Americans had for something new. It was really totally, initially at least, in reaction to the British.
Yeah. Actually, you know, you could almost say it was a conservative element, because what they wanted was nothing. They didn't want to create a new society. These New Englanders just wanted it to be the way it had always been. It was, if anyone was moving in a new direction, it was England, trying to organize themselves for, you know, the centuries to come. The New Englanders, but, you know, there was an extraordinary ambivalence. They were angry, but they still saw themselves as part of the British Empire. Even revolutionaries like Joseph Warren and Sam Adams regarded England as home. They insisted that independence was not a part of what they were talking about, and you know, and a real kind of strange logic, they said, you know, we are loyal to the king. It is the Parliament we have an issue with. They referred to the soldiers as the ministerial soldiers, while they were still flew the British flag and said that they were the ones being loyal to the king. You know, this infuriated King George, who said, wait a minute, don't pretend that you're loyal to me in all this. You know, in fact, he would be the one who said they were rebels. And once again, the British helped push this disagreement into the War of Independence it would ultimately become.
Talk a little bit about the siege aspect of this, because one of the things you deal with is what happened after Lexington and Concord, and who was left in the city at that point.
Yeah, I mean, this is in many ways the story of a city being turned inside out. The Patriot inhabitants flee. The soldiers arrive. It becomes and who is there? Who's a civilian? Are loyalists and some refugees, about 3,000 people. And so the British force would grow to almost 9,000, and it would become this British garrison, but cut off from the countryside around it. Since the British Navy had control of the harbor, they still were able to get food shipments and armaments from England and Canada to the north, but they were effectively sealed off from any fresh provisions and around them, and it created this very tense situation. Well, one British soldier described it as two wild cats staring at each other across a gutter, this siege that developed.
Talk about the violence that was pervasive in the city at that point.
Yeah, we like to think of our revolution as not all that brutal or violent compared to things like the French Revolution and things, and that's true to a certain extent. But there was real violence attached to this. The first chapter of my book talks about a gruesome tar and feathering that occurred in Boston, where when you get into the science, so to speak, of tarring and feathering, it's just horrible. Hot tar poured on naked flesh, feathers smeared on it, it effectively parboils the skin. And this customs inspector, loyalist, John Malcolm, after hours of being paraded through the city, his flesh would come off in what were described as steaks. And, this kind of thing was happening all the time. And it was not all ideology. It was almost a civil war in which families were torn apart by this. The Malcolms had one brother on one side, another brother on the other. And a city was just really put in a terrible time of turmoil.
Talk about the events that immediately preceded the Battle of Bunker Hill itself.
Yeah, well, after the 60 days after Lexington and Concord were extraordinarily tumultuous, where the provincials in Massachusetts were trying to organize themselves, and so they moved their provincial congress from Concord to Watertown to be closer to Cambridge, which was the military center that evolved as thousands of militiamen flooded in from the towns surrounding Boston. And Joseph Warren, as president of the provincial congress, was trying to organize that army, trying to deal with the refugees that were leaving Boston and had to be housed in towns throughout Massachusetts. And all the while, the British soldiers were digging in Boston and increasing their fortifications, while the Americans were doing the same thing in the town, in the areas surrounding the city. And it was in June of 1775 when the Americans got word that the British were planning an attack, a hope to punch through the American lines and send the rebel army reeling and effectively take Cambridge and Roxbury and put an end to this thing. And it could very easily have happened because this ragtag band of militiamen was poorly organized. And, it was just being created. And it was in an attempt to stall that attack that the decision was made to build a fortification on Bunker Hill on the Charlestown Peninsula.
And the image, though, of the townspeople watching this battle play out is fascinating.
We watch terrifying events on TV. Well, this was the Battle of Bunker Hill was a gruesome spectator sport where it all unfolded on the Charlestown Peninsula, half mile across the harbor from Boston. And so Bostonians took to the roofs of their houses where they sat and watched as 2,000 British soldiers were rowed across the harbor. It was a beautiful sunny day, very hot, there were British warships surrounding the Charlestown Peninsula, sending cannonballs whizzing into the Patriots, who were dug in at a fort on Breed's Hill, which is actually closer to Boston than Bunker Hill, and fortifications that went from that hill all the way across the peninsula to the Mystic River. And so they watched as these 2,000 soldiers in the resplendent scarlet uniforms were rowed across and began to march up this green hill towards the fortifications. At the same time, incendiaries were fired into the town of Charlestown, right beside these soldiers, and it ignited that city that went up in huge flames. And so you have this burning city beside this army that is marching towards this dug-in provincial army, and it's being watched by the citizens of Boston. And it just made for a scene that no one forgot. One British general, John Burgoyne, who was standing on Copp's Hill watching this, said, you know, the tension we felt as we watched what might determine the fate of the English-speaking world is impossible to describe.
And then after the battle's over, George Washington arrives. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, you know, so the battle ends, and the British get the fort. It's technically a British victory, but it was, as General Howe, who led the forces in the battle, said, it was a success too dearly bought. The British had suffered casualties of 50%. And everyone now knew that this was a war. You know, this was not just a rebellion. And Joseph Warren, who had been the leader of the province, was dead. And a few weeks after the battle, arrives the new commander-in-chief of what would become the Continental Army, George Washington. And he came from a very different mindset and culture than these Yankees. You know, he came from Virginia. He was a Virginia planter. He was in his early 40s. He was not yet the stoic icon that stares at us from the dollar bill. He was a fiery young guy who was appalled at what he found. These New Englanders did not take discipline very well. They were dirty. They did things on consensus, just like they did in town meetings. They weren't used to taking orders. And so he was kind of appalled at what he found, but he did the best he could. And what you have to say is, by trying to create an army that was more than New Englanders, because there were also people from Maryland and other colonies coming up, he was creating the beginnings of what would become America, where it's not just the colonies doing their own thing, it's everyone working together.
And he had a very different idea when he arrived than really what the prevailing ideas were in Boston at the time.
Yeah. I mean, Boston was a kind of a tribal community. You know, there was rampant anti-Catholicism. It was, you know, there were riots and things like that. And, you know, he didn't see it this way. He was a gentleman. And, you know, he wanted things to change and people to behave in a rather than, you know, in a thuggish manner, to behave as professional soldiers. And, you know, the other thing was, you know, he wanted the siege to get over with. He wanted to force it in some way. And the New Englanders weren't sure, after the trauma of Bunker Hill, exactly what they wanted to do. And so you see Washington injecting a kind of energy and discipline and rigor to this ragtag band of New Englanders was not met with absolute success, but began to subtly change things.
How did you view this through the lens of revolutions that we see today, and how different it was in so many respects and similar in some ways?
Well, yeah, you know, I was writing this book as the Arab Spring was unfolding in the Middle East, and you know, you can't. I mean, they're very different times, obviously, and very different technologies. Yeah, where, you know, Twitter and Facebook was such an issue in the Middle East. There was the communication was very different in New England, and you know. But one of the things I began to appreciate in a very basic way is, you know, the dynamics of a revolution are basically the same today as they were then, in terms of bringing down a regime. The hard part is what you do after that, and that's where some of the torturous process, and I think some of the more interesting parts of the story relate to the issues they were all grappling with in Massachusetts at this time. You know, how do we deal with an army in a, you know, with civil government? How do we manage that? How do we prevent things from becoming a totalitarian dictatorship? All of those kinds of issues. It's interesting to see, in a sense, that kind of thing still happening around the world.
There's also the degree we think of our own revolution as being so clear-cut. And in fact, like all of these revolutions, they kind of make it up as they go along.
Yes, I mean, that is so true. History gives us hindsight. And so there is this tendency to see it as a straight line towards the Declaration of Independence. And it was not that way. Accidents came into the you know, why did Joseph Warren decide to order Paul Revere to go? Technically, he did not have the right to do that, given the regulations that the provincial Congress had instituted when it came to putting out the call. You know, was it a calculated decision, or was it just an honest mistake, or, you know, what was going on? All of these contingencies were crowding in and occurring, where leading personalities suddenly vanish from the landscape. And then you have the great wild card, which I think defines so much of this growing conflict, was the Atlantic Ocean, the communication gap between Britain and the colonies. It took a month for a ship to cross the ocean and another month to go back. And so, you know, given the time lag, you were talking 2 to 3 months before you could get word back and forth. And this meant that when things started to go bad, it would be go from bad to worse, just given this communication lag.
Nathaniel Philbrick. The book is Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. Nathaniel, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it's been fun. Great to talk with you again.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.